Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 360, The Ties That Bind, part four, being recorded on May 19th of 2002. This broadcast will necessarily be referential to many other programs, both about September 11th and other subjects. I will refer listeners, time permitting, to Spitfire, a tape and CD duplication service that has all of the past broadcasts available. Also websites, including Spitfire's, which not only have real audio files available, but also, in response to many people who have asked me, when are you going to publish? When are you going to write a book? I am and I have. The program descriptions about September 11th, For the Record 325 and up, have detailed, annotated, and now reformatted descriptions, which collectively comprise a book. It's about 145, 150 pages, and it's available. It is as far away as the nearest library, the nearest computer terminal. It's there if you want to print it, and it's there if you want to read it, because I have bloody well written it, okay? And I am writing it. So get with the program. Now, continuing with The Ties That Bind, For the Record program number 360, The Ties That Bind, part four, François Genoux, Nazi banker, Odessa leader, primary operative on behalf of the Underground Reich, utilizing in a most cynical fashion the Arabs and other Muslim members of the population of what the Nazis called the Earth Island, the huge landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way on up through Europe, through most of the former Soviet Union, embracing most of the Middle East, China, and India. The Muslim population of that landmass, which also controls most of the world's oil reserves, have long been targeted by the Nazis as allies and proxy warriors. They, too, are considered lower evolutionary life forms, but they're considered useful, particularly when it comes to killing the British, American, and Jews. François Genoux, a primary Nazi banker, had befriended many of the Arabo-fascists and Islamo-fascists, including Haj Amin al-Husseini, himself a major in the SS, the recruiter of Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions, as I've spoken about in the past, and the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement. To give you an idea of how far back some of these ties that bind go, we're going to reprise an article that we excerpted in For the Record program 359. This article was originally published in the Philadelphia Inquirer of January 5th of 1997. It is by David Lee Preston, titled Hitler's Swiss Connection, and it's about François Genoux. And these ties have been binding for a long time. As a teenager in the fall of 1932, François Genoux briefly met the man who was to shape the rest of his life. In a hotel in Bad Godesberg, near Bonn, the young Genoux encountered Adolf Hitler, skipping down. In 1934, back in Switzerland, the 19-year-old Genoux joined the pro-Nazi National Front, and 2 years later, he began to forge the other political links that would prove so valuable. He traveled to Palestine, and there he met the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, the pro-Nazi religious and political leader of Palestinian Muslims, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was to spend most of World War II in Germany, and who, according to British author Gita Sereny, quote, would consider Genoux a confidant until his death in 1974. Genoux traveled to Berlin frequently during the war to see his friend, the Grand Mufti, unquote, and visited him afterward many times in Beirut, according to Le Monde correspondent Jean-Claude Buret. The Grand Mufti, quote, entrusted Genoux with the management of his enormous financial affairs, unquote, according to Sereny. And bear in mind the numerous allegations of links between Al-Taqwa, Genoux, the Clearstream Network, and September 11th, those discussed in past broadcasts. Now, considering also François Genoux's connections with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, in turn connected to Carlos the Jackal, the law firm of Jacques Vergès, one of whose members, Isabelle Couton-Père, is the French attorney for 20th hijacker Zacharias Moussaoui, as we've looked at in past programs. In For the Record program number 350, an excerpt of which we're about to reprise, we took a look at a statement by Sheikh Rahman in which he said, quote, The one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years, unquote. I've dealt with that in For the Record program number 339, I believe, 338, and also in number 349 and 350. I've speculated that the Kennedy referred to was Robert Kennedy. The patsy in the Robert Kennedy assassination was Siran Siran, a Palestinian Arab, and evidentiary tributaries there running in the direction of the underground Reich and related elements of U.S. intelligence, as we've discussed in the past. Now, in For the Record program 350, we talked about the evidentiary tributaries linking the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, its head George Habash and Wadi Haddad, and George's brother Fuad Habash with the assassination of Robert Kennedy. One of the PFLP hijackings that we took a look at in past discussions of Janu was the hijacking of a Lufthansa plane on February 21st, 1972. There was an interesting passenger, considering the one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years, turning again to the David Lee Preston article. More is to be learned about Janu's contact with the Americans. The State Department has yet to declassify 16 documents relating to Janu. 29 other documents relating to his application for a visa or permit to enter the U.S. remain classified. The Lufthansa Boeing 747 bound for Frankfurt was ready to take off in Bombay when the control tower received a bizarre message. Quote, "Call us the Victorious Jihad. If you call us Lufthansa, we won't answer you," unquote. It was the evening of February 21, 1972, and Palestinian hijackers had taken the plane hostage. Among the 188 passengers was Joseph Kennedy, 19-year-old son of assassinated Senator Robert F. Kennedy. The next day, a letter from Cologne demanded $5 million for the Organization for the Victims of the Zionist Occupation, unquote. In perfect English, the letter gave Lufthansa explicit instructions. A man carrying a suitcase with the money should wear a black jacket and gray pants, disembark at the Beirut airport holding Newsweek magazine in his left hand and the suitcase in his right hand, and go back to the parking lot. With the key in the envelope from Cologne, he was to open an old Volkswagen parked under a sycamore tree and read the instructions on the rear seat. The jet flew to Yemen, where the crew and passengers were freed, including the young Kennedy, and $5 million in used bills went to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which has committed numerous international terrorist attacks since. The operation was orchestrated by the Palestinian terrorist Wadi Haddad with the assistance of François Janu, who drove overnight to Cologne with his wife, carrying the letter with the ransom demand. After sending the letter to Lufthansa and to news agencies, Janu and Elisabeth took off for vacation in the Belgian Ardennes. Quote, "The amount of money demanded of Lufthansa was very high," Janu told French journalist Pierre Payen, revealing his role in the hijacking in a biography published this year in Paris. Quote, "Too low a number would have made us lose credibility. Too high a number might have made the operation fall through, especially considering how quickly the money had to be collected," unquote. Again, noting the PFLP Janu connection there, remember that Baudin Dunant, co-chairman of the board of SICO, the European branch of the Bin Laden business interest, business empire, was an attorney who represented Janu. What we're going to do next is to listen to an excerpt of For the Record program number 350, The One Who Killed Kennedy Was Trained for 3 Years, and bearing in mind just how far back some of these ties that bind go, bearing in mind that Joseph Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's son, was a passenger on this plane that was hijacked, let's listen to some of the other evidentiary tributaries by way of review. This again from For the Record program 350. What we're going to be doing as the first item up, so to speak, in this side is excerpting a section of RFA program number 8 that is about the assassination of Martin Luther King. As we've looked at in numerous broadcasts, including the Guns of November Part 4 and RFA number 8, among others, there are numerous evidentiary tributaries connecting the assassinations of both John Kennedy in November of 1963 with that of his brother Robert in June of 1968, and in turn connecting those assassinations to the assassination of Martin Luther King 2 months before Robert Kennedy was killed, and in turn those assassinations have strong evidentiary tributaries running to the shooting of George Wallace in May of 1972. Now, it is my belief, and this is conjectural, that Sheikh Rahman was alluding to the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The patsy in the Robert Kennedy assassination was a Palestinian Arab named Saran Saran. As we looked at in RFA program number 9, dealing with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the evidence suggesting that Saran was not the assassin but was the carefully manipulated patsy is very, very strong indeed. Saran, however, was a Palestinian Arab who ostensibly wanted to kill Robert Kennedy because of his support for Israel. The evidence suggests very strongly that, in fact, it was the same type of elements, in fact, the same elements who killed Robert Kennedy, the elements who killed Robert Kennedy were the same as those who had killed his brother and Martin Luther King. We concluded side one by examining a section of the book Government by Gunplay, co-authored or co-edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Azizian. In turn, we looked at an essay about the assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen, now associated with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. In turn, that essay dealt with, among other things, an affidavit submitted by Robert Byron Watson, who was working at the Magellan Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia. As we're going to look at in this excerpt of RFA program number 8, Robert Byron Watson had come across apparent elements of the assassination plot against Martin Luther King and against Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy was killed 2 months after Martin Luther King. And these assassinations, in turn, as we've looked at in other broadcasts, link up with the assassination of John Kennedy. Among the elements that you're going to hear described here are former U.S. Representative Larry McDonald of Georgia. Larry McDonald was in turn associated with Western Goals, an ultra-right-wing private intelligence organization that, among other things, was utilizing elements of the Los Angeles Police Department's Public Disorder and Intelligence Division to spy on people in Los Angeles. That case was the focal point of a civil suit, and before Larry McDonald could give evidence in that case, he was killed Korean Airlines Flight 007 was brought down. That was a major incident in the Cold War, and the evidence would suggest that it was not, in fact, the Soviets who brought that down, but that was the official version in what appears to have been either a provocation and or some other type of manipulated incident. We haven't got time to go into that now, but note the following excerpt from RFA 8, this is about the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Do note that Larry McDonald was connected with this milieu. Note, in particular, the name of Fuad Habash. Fuad Habash's name was apparently part of Fuad Habash, I should say, the brother of George Habash, about whom we're going to say more in a few minutes. Fuad Habash was connected to the group that appears, from the information we're about to hear, to have been connected to killing not only Martin Luther King, but also Robert Kennedy. Bear in mind that the patsy for the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Saran Saran, was a Palestinian Arab. It is my belief that Rahman was alluding to Saran Saran in the belief that it was actually Saran who committed the assassination. But note the name of Fuad Habash and the name of Anthony Malek, and note the connection of Fuad Habash to his brother George. This is from RFA number 8, recorded on April 4th, 1985, in addition to my own voice. You will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
Now, this article is entitled, this again, from the Hudson Valley Chronicle, July of 1977, Volume 1, Number 1. The article is entitled, King Assassination Conspiracy Revealed. This is by a man named David Wemple, W-E-M-P-L-E. And Wemple writes, Through nearly a decade of threats, blackmail, beatings, and murder attempts, Robert Byron Watson has steadfastly maintained that both the United States federal government and the forces of organized crime have persecuted, framed, and imprisoned him for one reason and one reason only: that he possesses knowledge implicating agents of these groups in a conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others. For those willing to hear his story, it should become readily apparent why the endless mysteries of America's political assassinations remain unsolved. When the intimacy existing between government, organized crime, and the intelligence community is laid out before one's eyes, it must seriously be questioned whether or not our present form of government can weather the intense scrutiny to which such knowledge must lead us. Watson was but a young man when, on March 28, 1968, he claims to have overheard a portion of the conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. As an acknowledged authority on art history and archaeology, even by those whom he most closely identifies with the conspiracy, he became employed at Magellan's Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia, and worked at the pricing of various artifacts. Magellan, by the way, is M-A-G-E-L-L-O-N. The gallery's business associates were fighting amongst themselves, however, by Christmas of 1967. It wasn't until a year or so later that Watson learned of the reason for this split. Bill Arnett, A-R-N-E-T-T, one of the original gallery partners, had apparently begun to suspect several others of using the gallery to front for illegal operations involving what Byron Watson consistently refers to in statements as, quote, the syndicate, unquote. The type of individual who often found his way to the halls of Magellan's, according to Watson, was characterized by a rather frequent visitor named Larry McDonald. A United States representative from Georgia, McDonald reigns from Marietta, from which the awesome and scandal-ridden Lockheed Corporation bases its East Coast operations. Aside from his membership on the John Birch Society's National Council, McDonald has been accused by the U.S. Labor Party and others of acting as a conduit for intelligence operations and various ultra-right-wing groups. In the meantime, he has gained a notoriety of sorts by saturating the congressional record with tirades like Maoist subversives in U.S. factories and Martin Luther King Jr.'s relationship with the communists. Within such an atmosphere of reactionary politics and corruption, says Watson, syndicate operations flourished, which included gold bullion smuggling from South America, as well as the importation upon a truly vast scale of cocaine and heroin.
Okay, skipping along in the article. The operations into which Byron Watson gradually became involved through this blackmail brought him an ever-increasing knowledge of organized crime and its relationship to the U.S. federal government. Although deeply involved in narcotics-related activities, he steadfastly maintains that he never took an active role in the actual trafficking, and that any, quote, evidence of this has been fabricated in a successful attempt to have him framed and imprisoned for the knowledge which he possesses. His awareness of drug smuggling activities, however, is substantial. While visiting Southeast Asia and purchasing huge amounts of artifacts for sale at Magellan's, for instance, he noticed that his traveling companion, Bill Jackson, was buying large quantities of teak logs. They were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. I should just mention that Bill Jackson, mentioned here in the article, is one of the people, I believe, that was mentioned as, along with Gene Purcell and Bill Jackson's brother, Herman Jackson, as being the people that were having a discussion with Jerry Adams about these people all, of course, being Byron Watson's employers, about the assassination of Martin Luther King. We're going to get back to Herman Jackson a little later on, but remember that Herman Jackson is one of the people involved in this, and this is his brother Bill Jackson that Watson is claiming was involved with buying these teak logs. Okay. These teak logs were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. A good deal of this information was forwarded by Watson to Atlanta Public Safety Commissioner A. Reginald Eaves. Eaves, whose, quote, conscience forced him to launch an investigation of Watson's charges in the summer of 1975, conceded that his drug-related data, at least, had proven to be, quote, about 95% accurate, unquote. The leads which Watson has provided in regards to the intimacy between government and syndicate, as well as about political assassinations, therefore may well be something to be reckoned with.
As fate would have it, Watson's hurried journey to Chile would provide a vital piece to the puzzle of the King assassination. It was while in Santiago that Byron found it literally impossible to receive any funds which had been sent to him from home. When there was some more money to be had, he was befriended by the South American director of the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Fuad Habash Ansara, whose brother George Habash is the leader of the National Front. Habash and Watson, as it turned out, had a mutual acquaintance who often visited Magellan's in Atlanta. That man, Dr. Anthony N. Malik, was the party named by Watson as buying the gold bullion which was being smuggled into the United States by Herman Jackson. Recall that Herman Jackson is the alias which apparently Jack Youngblood used, or someone who used a number of different names, including Jack Youngblood. Habash and others apparently suspected Malik of being a double agent with the CIA, a possibility which surfaced when Malik traveled to Chile immediately prior to the CIA-inspired coup d'etat against Allende in 1973. If Habash's suspicions were correct, Malik was one of those CIA agents who had attempted to infiltrate such national liberation organizations as the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Central Intelligence Agency has, in fact, carried out infiltrative and provocative acts against such American groups as the American Indian Movement, Black Panthers, and Students for a Democratic Society. Later in 1974, Watson claims that Herman Jackson told him that Malik was also, quote, the man who conceived most of the plan and worked out most of the details which were employed to assassinate Senator Robert Kennedy.
Now, again, note the name of Fuad Habash, who was part of that milieu, apparently involved, at least according to Robert Byron Watson, whose investigations or whose allegations were to a considerable extent, as we looked at in Side 1, supported by subsequent investigations, of the name of Fuad Habash, the brother of George Habash, should be noted in that regard. Note also that one of the associates of Fuad Habash was Anthony Malik, according to Robert Byron Watson, one of the key players in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And again, the patsy in that assassination, Saran, was a Palestinian Arab who supposedly killed Robert Kennedy because of his antipathy to Kennedy's support for Israel. That again, excerpted from For the Record program number 350, and in turn, you heard an excerpt from RFA number 8. Now, jumping from the milieu of François Genoux and the PFLP, and it's not much of a jump at all, bear in mind that Genoux protégé and lawyer for Klaus Barbie, Jacques Vergès, has one of his protégés and fellow attorneys in his law firm, Isabelle Couton-Père, representing the 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui. In this past week, as I speak, on May 19th of 2002, the disclosures about Zacharias Moussaoui and the 20th hijacker have been in the news. The New York Times of Wednesday, May 15th of 2002, Washington, May 14th, article by David Johnston, headlined, Pre-attack memo cited Bin Laden, subtitled, New details of FBI agents warning on flight schools. And by the way, in For the Record program 349, I supplemented my speculation that the FBI has actually been subverted from within as part of an operational plan to subvert and destroy the United States with ideological prongs from both the right and the left from within the country. This is like the attack on France in World War II. It is an attack from without at the same time as it is being coupled by a subversive effort from within, that coming from both the right and the left. Now, of Zacharias Moussaoui and these warnings alluded to in the article of May 15th of 2002 from the New York Times, skipping down. The memorandum may not be the only internal document embarrassing to the Bureau. In August, an agent speculated in notes made when investigators sought to explain why Zacharias Moussaoui was enrolled in a Minnesota flight school that Mr. Moussaoui might be planning to fly a plane into the World Trade Center. Mr. Moussaoui, a French citizen, was soon arrested on immigration charges believed by the United States government to be the intended 20th hijacker on September 11th. Now, more about forewarnings of this plan. The New York Times of Saturday, May 18th of 2002, has the following article by Philip Sheenan, Dateline Washington, May 17th, headlined, FBI knew for years about terror pilot training. And this alludes to a disclosure that came from the Philippines. Skipping down. However, alluding to the memorandum that we heard about earlier, however, the Phoenix Memorandum was not the first warning that terrorists affiliated with Al-Qaeda had interest in learning to fly. In his 1996 confession, a Pakistani terrorist, Abdul Hakim Murad, said that he planned to use the training he received at flight schools in the United States to fly a plane into CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, or another federal building. Mr. Murad, who was captured in the Philippines in 1995 and convicted in New York on charges of conspiring to blow up 12 American jumbo jets over the Pacific simultaneously, received flight training at schools in New York, North Carolina, California, and Texas. Information from Mr. Murad's confession formed a basis for an analysis prepared for United States intelligence agencies in 1999. The analysis warned that bin Laden terrorists could hijack a jet and fly it into government buildings like the Pentagon. Now remember Hakim Murad, we're going to review an element of Operation Bojinka, Serbo-Croatian for Big Bang. This from the book Al-Qaeda, subtitled Brotherhood of Terror by Paul L. Williams. This book was published in softcover by Alpha, a division of Pearson Education, copyright 2002, ISBN 0-02-864352-6. Of Hakim Murad, Operation Bojinka, links between Ramzi Youssef, the first World Trade Center attack, and the attack on the Oklahoma City building, the blowing up of the Oklahoma City building. While making final preparations for Bojinka, the terrorists met with Terry L. Nichols several times in Cebu City, the Philippines. Nichols, along with Timothy McVeigh, were charged with the bombing of the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building in Oklahoma City on April 19, 1995, that killed 168 people and wounded another 600. Some FBI officials now believe that Nichols, who has a mail-order Filipino wife from Cebu, obtained contact with Youssef through Muslim students at Southwest College in Weatherford, Oklahoma. The officials further believe that Youssef and Murad provided Nichols with training in making and handling bombs. Without such instruction, Nichols and McVeigh would not have been able to assemble a 5,600-pound bomb made of ammonium nitrate and nitromethane. Several informants recently gave testimony that they met Nichols with Youssef in the Philippines and that the American was affectionately known there as the farmer, unquote. Bear in mind that Timothy McVeigh was witnessed in combination with Middle Eastern men. His attorney was, or his protege, he was the protege in turn of Andreas Strassmeyer, the son of Gunter Strassmeyer, Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff, the architect of German reunification and a charter member of the Nazi Party. Andreas Strassmeyer's attorney was Aryan Nations attorney Kirk Lyons. So connect the dots. Those are the ties that bind. Note that there are now warnings of a new attack, possibly nuclear. Various programs that I've done are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, one word, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, email, mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Visit their Real Audio Equipped website at www.spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section, there are detailed annotated descriptions of all of the programs I've done about September 11th. Those are the book that I'm writing and have published, so you check it out. There are also links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU in Jersey City, New Jersey, with all of the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming, others available for download only. And in response to those who have asked, well, when are you going to write a book? When are you going to publish? That is on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. I have. It's there. If you want it, print it and read it. Get with the program, so to speak, or else you will pay the price. That concludes For the Record program number 360. The Ties That Bind, Part 4, being recorded on May 19th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.